Mr. Olson.
May it please the court, this case presents some genuinely interesting questions of law. I want to start, though, with about 30 seconds on one of the questions that's not very interesting, but kind of mundane. There are some scope of the charge defenses in the defendant's brief. They argue that some of the claims are outside the scope of the administrative charges as to specific accommodations that were requested by Mrs. Segan. I think those defenses were waived by not being presented in the district court. They're not discussed in Judge Shabazz's decision. I think also that they're not relevant to the Rehabilitation Act brand of the accommodation claim, and I don't think that Rehabilitation Act claim was waived. And finally, the scope of the administrative charges is not precisely what controls the scope of the case in court. It's the scope of an investigation that might reasonably have arisen out of the administrative charges. So for all of those reasons, we think the scope of charge defenses are not dispositive.
Mr. Olson, I'll tell you one of the things that concerns me in your case. Before one can draw an inference that efforts on the part of an employer that would be related to some disability stem from the ADA, stem from a feeling that one is in a position where ADA compliance is necessary, you need some indication of that. And your opponent suggests that the depositions and the evidence to which you're pointing in your brief on that point is not properly in the record. And otherwise, just because they say we're trying to help you out, in effect, or yes, we recognize that you have a problem, isn't enough to connect it to actual ADA responsibilities. And indeed, we wouldn't want it to, because we don't want to build a disincentive into the system for employers to be sympathetic to problems that are not as severe as the ADA would call for, but that are nonetheless real.
Good questions, both. The deposition of Mrs. Segan is in the record. The depositions of Annette Bommersbach, the school district people, are not, but we don't need them.
Right, and you can't use them, and you shouldn't have referred to them, but
everybody thought they were, both sides mistakenly thought they were in the record in the different
what line, I was not bowled over by the language that you were referring to from which you were drawing the inference that this was an actual statement that there is an ADA-level disability that was at least regarded as being present.
Here's the... This is all in the proposed findings of fact and the defense response thereto, so we don't need the depositions. And the proposed findings of fact are in the reply brief appendix, in the second half of that appendix. The first half is the pretrial order that gives the defense responsibility to respond to proposed findings and holds that they'll be taken as fact if they're not properly objected to. And what we show in these proposed findings again and again, for example, at 60, Dr. Annette claiming that he didn't know whether he formed an opinion as to whether Mrs. Segan had a disability that was entitled to an accommodation, but saying that if a doctor says you have a disability, you try to accommodate it.
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent example of my problem, actually, because he doesn't have an opinion about whether there's a legal entitlement, but he's treating it as a disability claim and says, if you have it, you try to accommodate it. Well, I mean, there are all kinds of disability claims, as you know, even the one in Sutton, for example. It's not that the Supreme Court doesn't think these people have problems. They do. But is it such a severe problem that affects a major life activity? That's a different issue. And I'm not sure Dr. Annette is saying anything, but you know, even when people have these other level of problems, you try to accommodate it. That would be the decent thing to do, wouldn't it?
I agree that if an employer says we're just trying to accommodate somebody as a decent thing to do.
Well, as a disability.
Try to accommodate somebody's disability as the decent thing to do. It doesn't mean that the employer holds they have a disability under the ADA, but I think when an employer says we thought we had a legal duty to accommodate, then it is saying that there's
paragraph 60, to which you've just pointed, doesn't say that.
It doesn't. But then go on to 91, where Munyon and other district administrators were well aware that if Mrs. Segan was disabled, she had a right to a reasonable accommodation.
All right, but that paragraph doesn't do it either. That's an if-then.
Right, but then it goes on to 92 and 93, where...
Never determined that she was not entitled isn't the same thing, double negatives to one side, to say they did determine that she was, is it?
Then go over to the next page of 114, 116, etc., where they have all kinds of meetings, and nobody in these meetings ever says, we don't think that Mrs. Segan is legally entitled to a disability or to an accommodation. Rather, everybody proceeds in good faith as if she is entitled to a reasonable accommodation. That's covered again beginning at proposed finding 129 and going on through 133. 133, for example, the discussions in which Mr. Munyon participated proceeded on the basis that Mrs. Segan probably was entitled to some reasonable accommodation, but reasonable people could differ about in any event, I think it's that admission that they were having meetings and proceeding upon the belief that Mrs. Segan was legally entitled to a reasonable accommodation that takes this case over the tox hump of people just using the word disabled in a colloquial sense. They're clearly saying that she's disabled in a sense of legal entitlement to accommodation.
There's nothing clear about it. I mean, the closest you've come to, I think, is paragraph 133, which has the qualifying word probably.
Well, and probably is good enough in a preponderance of the evidence case, I think.
Well, we're not there. We're trying to figure out, did anybody think that there was, that they were operating under the ADA? To say, well, probably let's resolve doubts in favor of trying to accommodate her is not quite the same thing as a clear finding.
I think
anyway, and what's wrong with the accommodations they give her anyway? Suppose we go all the way down the road with you and we say that, yes, they did regard her as having a disability that falls within the definition of the ADA, and they're making various accommodations. What's wrong with what they did?
Well,
they did quite a bit.
To take the first one she requested, which was a chair to sit on for 10 minutes of her class period, the district tried to pass off as a reasonable accommodation, letting her sit in these child chairs in an elementary school, which were tremendously inadequate, probably hurt the situation rather than helped it. She said, I want an adult padded chair. And it took 2 years to get it. They eventually did get that for her after the union got involved. And they had this meeting on April 30th, 2002. Union people came in and talked to Annette. Annette did his memo, which is Segan Exhibit 147, and said, well, this is a complicated and contentious issue, but shortly after that, they give her the chair. They don't give her the 15-minute break in the morning that she wants, and everybody's trying to pass off onto everybody else the responsibility for making those tough decisions that are going to affect other people's schedules.
Could I ask you another question? Does the record reflect anywhere the nature of her contract, tenure provisions, and her expectation of renewal in the contract? Because it's not like they bounce her out midway through the year. They choose not to renew, and I'm just interested what there is in the record about expectations of renewal.
The precise contract, I don't believe, is in the record.
I'm interested in pursuing that a little more. What relief do you want concretely?
We want damages for...
Damages for what? Did Segan lose any income before she quit?
No, she did not. So she would be entitled to damages for the physical distress of not getting the accommodations, and then we want damages for the termination, which we...
There wasn't any termination.
Well, a constructive discharge. She was told her termination.
She was told that discharge would be recommended, and then she quit. But there's a big difference between recommending non-renewal or discharge and actually discharging somebody.
Maybe right? At some point.
If the dean of some department says, we're going to recommend that Jones not get tenure, and Jones quits, that's very different from actually turning Jones down for tenure.
I think that depends on the dean's track record. If the dean
federal courts are very bad at speculating about dean's track record. Look, the Supreme Court has said that the doctrine of constructive discharge is available only if, to use the language from Souter's, there are unendurable working conditions. And quitting because somebody has a recommendation for a discharge doesn't sound like itself an unendurable working condition.
Every time Dr. Annette had recommended a non-renewal, it had been approved by the school board. This court said that...
Yeah, but what about a recommendation makes working conditions unendurable?
It's not...
Like the legal standard is unendurable working conditions.
Well, this court has also said in the Chicago Hospitals case that if an employer conveys to an employee that the employee is going to be fired and the employee quits, that's a constructive discharge as well.
Not clear that anything of that kind survives Souter's. Supreme Court says constructive discharge depends on unendurable working conditions, and my question is, what in this record shows that the working conditions were unendurable?
The fact that Mrs. Segan was continuing to be required to work more hours than her doctor said she could healthfully work, and that she had to take disability retirement before serving out the end of the school year because the school district had not reduced her class number, her number of hours per week. Another interesting question this case presents is whether a regarded as plaintiff is afforded some sort of second-tier protection under the Disability Act. We contend that there is no two-tier scheme of protection under the Disability Act, and that Congress very easily could have created one if it would have wanted to, and what it chose to do was to make all three classes of disabled people, those who are actually disabled, those who are regarded as disabled, and those who have a record of disability, entitled to the same protections. And we don't think the courts have any business in getting into the area of slicing off parts of that class of disabled people and saying you're not entitled to the full protection of the Act. Equally importantly, I think, when you start saying we're going to give employers a defense in regarded as cases and say there's no duty of accommodation, you put that together with the idea that employers only have to accommodate the disabilities they know about, and you create a disincentive for them to learn about their employees' disabilities, because if they keep themselves ignorant of the medical evidence, they can say, we didn't know for sure this person was disabled, even though they turn out to have been actually disabled, she was just a regarded as case to us. So we had no duty to accommodate because this circuit says we have no duty to accommodate regarded as plaintiffs. I don't think that's the direction in which we want to steer the incentive set for employers. I think the Chicago Hospitals case does survive the Supreme Court's treatment of constructive discharge, because I don't think the Supreme Court directly considered one way or the other the situation that was presented in Chicago Hospitals, and I think until that situation is clearly presented to the Supreme Court and either accepted or rejected by that court, this court should continue to abide by its previous holding. I'd like to save the rest of my time if I may.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Olson. Mr. Copa.
Counsel, Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Joseph Copa. I'm here to represent the Chippewa Falls School District in this matter before the court. We're here on two issues, Your Honors. We're here on the district court's decision to grant summary judgment to the school district on appellant's regarded as claim. And I'm asking this court to affirm the district court's decision in that respect. Second issue we're here for today is with respect to the district court's granting of summary judgment as to the constructive discharge claim of appellant. And again, I am asking this court to affirm that decision. With respect to the regarded as claim, there are several reasons why I believe this court should affirm the district court. The first is when we focus in on the very basic standard that this court has established in regarded as cases, there is an absence of evidence in the record to establish a genuine issue of material fact. And the standard is that the employer must mistakenly believe that a person has a physical impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities, or mistakenly believe that an actual non-limiting impairment substantially limits one or more major life activities. There is no evidence in this record of any such mistaken belief. The evidence of record, Your Honors, is that the appellant had certain medical conditions. That's clear. These conditions were reported to the school district. And there were work restrictions that were issued. The school district accepted this information and worked to come up with plans to bring these restrictions into compliance so that the appellant could be successful at her job. There are several cases cited in the briefs before this court that I think are on point here, one of which is the Lusk case, which is a Tenth Circuit case, and that is a case involving an employer who accepted information about a plaintiff's lifting restrictions, and there was a regarded as claim made in that case, and the court found that was not an appropriate case for a regarded as claim to survive because there was no evidence of an erroneous perception on the part of the employer.
Now, but what do you think, Mr. Copa, would be good enough? Now, clearly, if the school district had sent Ms. Segan a letter saying, we realize that you are entitled to reasonable accommodation under the ADA, fine. You know, that wouldn't be a tough case. Circumstantially, though, is there anything short of a letter like that that you think would suffice to show that the district's behavior was, as it were, under legal compulsion as opposed to simply some business policy of being accommodating that it might have?
Your Honor, I think the standard is just as you've articulated it there. The school district would have to essentially engage in conduct such as writing a letter.
But what, I mean, is there something other than articulating the words in print or in a conversation, Americans with Disabilities Act, is there anything circumstantial? Because what I understand Ms. Segan to be arguing is that when there is a course of conduct as long as this, where clearly they are working toward an accommodation for some reason, that's the issue, of course, but at some point you can draw an inference that what's going on is because of the ADA and because of a regarded as claim, not the other. Now, it's an important question in that it goes to not only evidence, but really the scope of the regarded as part of the statute.
Your Honor, I think there would need to be evidence of other conduct on the part of the employer which would give rise to a reasonable inference that there were certain major life activities, significant life activities, where they didn't have a basis, a medical basis or otherwise, for believing that the plaintiff would not be able to function in those areas and that there would be conduct that would demonstrate that perhaps the employer was stretching it and extending what they thought was a medical condition into areas that were not substantiated by information, medical information, that had been brought to their attention. And in this case, we certainly do not have any of that.
Well, so you think if there was some communication that referred to one of the things in the list of major life activities that the statute and the regulations recognize, that would be enough?
I don't think one would be enough, Your Honor, but certainly if...
Why is there a more than one requirement from the Supreme Court? I mean, if one of the major life activities that the statute refers to, walking, you know, perhaps, or something, if one of those is at issue, why do you need two?
I don't think it's a one or two thing, Your Honor, but I think the point I'm trying to make, and probably not very well, is if there was evidence in the record that the employee had a condition,
mm-hmm.
and we saw evidence of conduct where there was no connection between what the employer was doing in that condition, no reasonable correlation, you could probably raise an inference that the employer was reading into it something that should not be read into it. But again, that's not the situation we have in this case here. What we have is the case where the employer relies on information that's given and works with the employee, much like occurred in the Mack case, which was before this court, where the court recognized that there has to be evidence that the employer regarded the employee as having a substantial limitation in activities that are substantial in most people's daily life. And we don't have any evidence of that in this case. We have evidence that the school district embraced the conditions that were passed on and worked with the appellant to try to make her successful in the workplace. I should just note along this line that a case cited in the appellant's brief, Dupree, also speaks to this issue. It is, interestingly, a case where the appellant had back problems, and the same line of reasoning as in Mack and Lust was embraced by the Fifth Circuit, that there is nothing illegal about an employer embracing factual information that is provided by a physician. And unless there is evidence that the employer is perceiving something beyond that, there is no violation of the ADA under a regarded as theory. Another point that's important here, I believe, for the court's consideration is the appellant is making the contention that she was significantly impaired in her daily life, and that premise in and of itself is not borne out by her own sworn deposition testimony. When she was asked under oath whether she was significantly impaired, she said that she was not. She said that she was somewhat impaired. That was the words that she used. Then she went on to say later in the deposition on page 99 that the basis for her regarded as claim when this case began was a statement that she attributes to Dr. Annette. And those were the statements or words to that effect that you brought to the attention of counsel a few minutes ago, where we were talking about the double negative. He was not denying that she was not disabled. And we know from this court's holding in Tokes that the mere fact that the word disabled or handicapped or words to that effect are used does not denote that an employer is regarding an employee as disabled for purposes of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We also have heard argument here today and read it in the brief of the appellant that she believes Dr. Annette and others regarded her as substantially limited in her ability to stand. Okay. There's a couple problems with that. Number one, she didn't regard herself as substantially limited in her ability to stand. If you look at her sworn deposition testimony, she had some problems, but If you go through that, she's able to shower, albeit she can't reach her back. She's able to mop. She's able to do some work around the house. She's able to cook. This is not a person who even sees herself as substantially limited in the ability to stand.
Would you like to comment on the question whether the American Hospital notion of constructive discharge survives the Souter's decision?
I think Judge Easterbrook was correct that the standard was changed as a result of Souter's, and the standard is much higher. That being said,
isn't the real question after Souter's, when did the discharge happen? I mean, sometimes we have cases where, say, a president of a university says, I've decided you're not going to get tenure, and then later on the board of trustees or somebody like that rubber stamps it, and there can be timing questions as to was it the date of the president's letter or the date of the board of trustees, or perhaps here the date of Superintendent Arnett's recommendation or the hypothetical date in the future when the school board might have done it. But isn't that really what this other branch is looking at? I mean, surely if de facto the superintendent's decision was the final decision, you might at least have some argument to make that was when you got fired or non-renewed or what have you. Unfortunately, I guess the record, do you agree with this? The record does not tell us about the difference between non-renewal in her case and termination.
Yes, I do agree with that. There is nothing in the record, as counsel stated, about the implications of non-renewal in the contract. But if we look at the issue of constructive discharge, and we look at the concept of the provisional notice of non-renewal and the evidence in this record, I do not believe that it arises to the requisite standard here. The evidence is that Dr. Annette was not and is not and never has been the decision maker.
Well, and Wisconsin law provides a very complex mechanism for non-renewing teachers, doesn't it? There are all kinds of dates that have to be met and hearings you're entitled to if you want to contest your non-renewal due process hearings and that sort. The record doesn't tell us anything about what would have been available in Chippewa Falls if she was contested. And that's what Mr. Olson says. Well, as soon as the superintendent said we're going to, I think, start the non-renewal process, the game was over here. I don't think the record supports that, does it?
I don't think the record does support that. I think the first step that was taken, and you're correct, the process is complicated, it is complex, but the first step in that process that Dr. Annette is required by law to undertake is to give the provisional notice. If you look at Ms. Segan's testimony about what happens next, she is given a copy of the statute, albeit that being a significant, complicated statute. She goes to the union to get advised as to what happens next. She requests a hearing and later withdraws that hearing when she chooses to resign. Okay, she doesn't quit, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out here. It's not a quit situation. It's a resignation situation. Furthermore, there is no evidence in...
difference between quitting and resigning.
Well, she didn't... The point that I'm not articulating well is that she didn't quit immediately. This is the person who was claiming that the work situation was so intolerable, and the evidence of record is that she, after she gives her notice, she stays on for a couple of months.
She's really trying to say she was de facto fired the day that the provisional recommendation was made. And I thought what you were trying to say is that the evidence showed that she either A, quit, or B, resigned, you know, using those as a synonym, she was not pushed out the door.
That's true.
Okay.
I take it you would not be arguing, if this were a case involving the statute of limitations, that you have only a 270 days or 180 maybe in Wisconsin from the time the process starts to file your charge with the EEOC.
No. Just to finish up on the constructive discharge issue, the evidence of record is that the ultimate decision maker here was the board. and no such decision was ever made. There's been reference by counsel to the prior occasions where Dr. Annette had put forth recommendations for non-renewal. There's no evidence in the record that the appellant ever even knew about that or that entered into the equation when she got this. She testified that she didn't know exactly what it meant, and that's why she went to the union for advice about a hearing. And the reason that that's important is that the person has to perceive the situation as being so intolerable that it essentially amounts to the employer saying, you know, we want you to quit. And a reasonable person would not do that given the circumstances of this case. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Coba. Anything further, Mr. Olson? You must have about 22 seconds.
Thank you. I've got two quick points. The apex of the mountain of evidence that the district perceived Ms. Segan to be disabled is proposed findings 114 and then 120 and 121. They say that Bommersbach, the elementary school coordinator, attended a few meetings in which Mrs. Segan's request for accommodations were discussed, and then I quote, to Mr. Bommersbach, Dr. Annette seemed to be proceeding in good faith as if he had a legal duty to accommodate Mrs. Segan's disability. Mm-hmm. I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.